Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Market Show. I'm John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle, joined today by Phil Oakley. How are you doing, Phil?
Very good, thanks, John.
Excellent. And we've got lots to talk about. There's lots of exciting news at the moment.
It's been an interesting week.
Yeah, I mean, really odd news as well in some respects. I mean, we're going to talk about M&S and Ocado and their joint venture, which is odd.
Very odd.
We're going to talk about the house builders and particularly Persimmon, whose profits are enormous.
Yeah.
And raise some questions. We're going to talk about Purple Bricks while we're on the subject of housing, their profit warning, and what the future has in store for the alternative estate agency model. And we're going to talk about Amazon, which is the subject of your column this week. And while we talk about Amazon, which obviously provides a nice TV streaming service, we can talk about ITV and the BBC and their incredible plans to launch a joint venture in streaming, which I can't get my head around. Let's try and get to grips with that. Shall we start with M&S and Ocado? We've talked about Ocado a lot on this podcast. There has been speculation that M&S would try and get into online food for some time and that this might be the route they take. Is this a good idea for them?
Well, I don't think anyone's surprised about this at all. It's almost like Ocado has been casting a line for Marks and Spencer to come and bite and reel it in because it's the obvious fish that it needs to catch. In many ways, this is it's a fascinating deal in many respects. I'm not sure it means any upside to the shareholders of either company. Marks and Spencer's has been the obvious missing party from, apart from the discounters, of course, who haven't been selling food over the internet. And this is something that they've not done, not even looked like doing, for years and years and years. And Ocado has obviously been pointed out by many people as the obvious solution for them to do this. And they've gone ahead and done it. But whether it's going to work for them, whether it's going to generate any fresh sales, whether they're going to do something that nobody really has done, which is to make money from selling food over the internet, is very, very unclear. And they've paid a lot of money to have a go at doing this.
So they're paying £750 million for a 50% stake in this joint venture, which is, as you pointed out earlier, values essentially Ocado's retail operation at £1.5 billion.
Yeah, and this is the thing that no one really, very few people seem to have picked up on, is that Ocado has essentially said, yep, I'm happy to sell or to give a valuation for our UK retail business of £1.5 billion. And I think that sends a very, very, very clear message, actually, to how profitable this business can become. And my view is that it actually gives plenty of fuel for the sceptics of Ocado that, you know, they've bitten the hand off M&S for this.
You could argue, though, that Ocado don't really care anymore because their new stated strategy is to be a technology provider.
They do care because they need money. They are building out, or they just finished out, building out a new warehouse in southeast London. I've got a lot of investment requirements over the next few years in terms of spending on tech, spending on robots, grids for their new customers.
But you say they need money, but these things don't make any money. I mean, the money that they've got is essentially £750 million from Marks and Spencer.
Yeah, and that's why they need the money.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so the company is, you know, it's not making any profits. It's spending a lot of money. Its debt's going up. And I think this will probably, I think they're getting £562 million up front, and then potentially £750 million in total, subject to how this business performs over the next 5 years. This will clear pretty much all Ocado's debt in one fell swoop.
Okay, I guess, I mean, we talked a lot about the Ocado side of things. You know, I guess now we should perhaps focus on the M&S side of things and what this means for them as a business. I mean, if you're a shareholder, you might not be very happy because they've had to cut the dividend to fund this.
And ask shareholders for £600 of fresh money.
It's pretty significant if you're a shareholder. I mean, and I guess, you know, a lot of Marks & Spencer shareholders are long-standing shareholders and shareholders that rely on Marks & Spencer for that dividend.
Yeah, but let's be honest, John. Marks & Spencer's dividend's been hanging by a thread for some time.
Yeah, but companies do have a tendency to you know, pay the dividend at all costs. And Marks & Spencer's has been one of those companies. And yet here we are. It's cut it. The shares fell. They can't be very happy.
No, I think this is not good if you're a Marks & Spencer shareholder. The whole decision, the cost of it, what you're having to give up in terms of your dividend. You know, shareholders are being asked to carry a very high price to let Marks & Spencer's try and have a go at making money from selling food. And I think there are lots of questions to be asked as to whether Marks & Spencer's has got the right brand, the right customer appeal to actually make this work. Because, you know, one of the things that strikes me is that, you know, the basket size of Marks & Spencer's food is actually pretty small. And if you look at the kind of basket size that you need, to be sort of selling week in, week out online to make the economics stand up, it's, you know, it's, you've got to be sort of getting over, you know, 80 to, towards 80, 100 pounds.
Yeah, and that's what strikes me as very interesting. You know, the M&S food experience is not akin to the Tesco, the weekly shop at Tesco, no. The weekly shop at Morrison's or Sainsbury's.
Yeah.
It's a very different thing. This is like a big leap for them. Yeah, it's food, but it's not what they do.
No.
So, no, yeah.
And it's, you know, is this going to transform, is this going to generate fresh sales for Marks & Spencer's food? I think, you know, it's by no means certain that's going to happen.
It sounds like they're going to have to you would imagine they would have to pump an enormous amount of money into marketing this to potential new customers who might consider M&S for a weekly shop, which they have never done before. It's a new proposition.
They've never done before, and it's never really been the kind of place that you could go for a weekly shop, given where a lot of their stores are based. They're not really the sort of place where you can go in, fill your trolley up and walk out to your car park because your car's like half a mile away.
That might be the part of the strategic rationale, though.
Yeah.
Because the shops can't support the weekly shop habits.
Yeah.
They can only do that online. So it's a stretch, but there is a rationale in that respect.
But does Marks & Spencer's have the right price point to shift a significant amount of volume of food via this venture? I'm not sure it has.
It's interesting. I mean, other things we haven't talked about. I mean, the supply chain to support this, you know, if they do intend to grow it significantly and to be able to offer the kind of weekly shop that will make this economic, presumably it has massive implications for their supply chain and their ability to even do this.
Yeah. Yeah, it does.
It just seems like a significant investment is still to come.
Yeah.
Not just the price they've paid,
no.
But how they re-engineer their business,
yeah,
to be able to deliver this.
Absolutely. And the stock market gave it a big thumbs down.
Yeah, which, I mean, you could say perhaps that was just because they're raising a lot of money, but is that a thumbs down to the strategy as well? Maybe it is.
Probably a combination of lots of things, but this deal is a good deal for Ocado, verging on a great one. Because it crystallises 750 million of value, 50% of their business when their business isn't making any money. It also solves the issue with Waitrose supply, because that agreement's coming to an end.
1st of March, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's days away.
So Marks & Spencer's helps out Ocado by a clean swap of Waitrose supply for Marks & Spencer's supply.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I'm sort of thinking is, what happens to the actual pricing point of a weekly shop via Ocado now? Because, yes, there may be price matching, but is Marks & Spencer's food or a basket or a selection of a basket of Marks & Spencer's food going to cost more than Waitrose? And therefore, Ocado's offer to consumers actually becomes more expensive.
I think it's very strange. I mean, Marks & Spencer's does not have the same stock keeping unit range as other supermarkets.
No.
It's just a very different business. I'm scratching my head here.
It almost smacks of desperation from Marks & Spencer's, really.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's move away from Marks & Spencer's, who we've also written about in the magazine, as well as your Alpha newsletter this week. Harriet Russell has had a look at that. She's not convinced, unsurprisingly. Let's look at Persimmon, who Jonas has covered this week, who've had some quite spectacular results. The house builders, and I guess Persimmon, are kind of the standard bearer of everything that you hate about the current house building industry, Phil.
Yeah, I actually had a very interesting debate on Twitter about this over the weekend. And someone pointed out that I hate house builders. I don't hate house builders, I just hate Help to Buy. Because I think it is a bizarre scheme that really hasn't done a lot of good unless you're a shareholder of a house building company.
I guess if you were a supporter of the Help to Buy scheme, maybe even if you were in government making decisions around funding the Help to Buy scheme, you might argue that Help to Buy has allowed many first-time buyers to fulfil the dream of home ownership.
Yeah, and what the government will also say is that the money they've pumped in to Help to Buy is actually currently sitting at a profit because that equity is worth a little bit more than what they put in from 2013 onwards. But it is a bizarre scheme that doesn't really deal with the main problem in the housing market. The problem in the housing market is lack of supply. This is a demand-based policy by putting money in people's pockets. When you put money in people's pockets, prices tend to go up. And that's exactly what's happened with the housing market and also the new build market in particular, because Help to Buy has been removed from the existing market. That was done in December 2016. And for one reason or another, and I don't think the two are unrelated, the existing housing market is flat as a pancake. In fact, it's probably nudging downwards.
Yeah, and we're seeing evidence of that in the results of some of the estate agency businesses like Purple Bricks, for
example. But what's happening with the new build market is that you're still getting some house price inflation.
Not a lot. I think it was 1% in Persimmon's numbers.
Yeah, it's not a lot, but what's been happening cumulatively over the last few years is that premium between a new build house and an equivalent existing house on the secondary market has been getting bigger. And that premium has been going into the pockets of the shareholders of building companies.
You might have some angry people getting in touch with you about a claim like that, but your view, and it's something I've also pointed out in my editorial this week, this is akin to something that we might describe as crony capitalism.
Yeah. People can be angry all they want, right? I'll stand by and defend this, because you can go and walk around or go on Rightmove and look at what these builders are advertising, selling properties for. And a lot of it is indisputable in terms of you go and look at a certain type of house, go and look at an existing one round the corner for sale, and the difference in price is big. 10-15%. Now, whether they actually sell for those prices is another matter, because what's also going on is that if you look carefully and you go and visit a few building sites, and I've been known to walk past a few, is that there are quite a lot of incentives that go on. For example, we'll pay your mortgage for 12 months, but don't let us cut the selling price. We'll pay your mortgage, or we'll do some part exchange deal. Help to Buy, I think it's irrefutable that Help to Buy has increased prices. And the windfall has come because the building companies have been selling these Help to Buy houses on land that they bought very cheaply. And so the assumptions of the price that they were going to sell for have been massively exceeded, and that is a windfall that is in terms of absolute profits that has accrued to house building companies. Now, I think that windfall is going to level off a bit now in terms of absolute profits as new land comes into the system. But there is no doubt that in my mind that Help to Buy has been manna from heaven for house builders.
Yeah, and there has been some controversy around this industry, and in particular the amount of money that's being paid to some of the executives within the industry. And, you know, I think shareholders have been... There has been some noise around this, some dissatisfaction, but actually shareholders have done very well out of this as well. The capital returns have been absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, but it's not just the capital returns. I think, you know, one of the points I can't get across strongly enough is that if you look at the way that house building works, it's essentially a function of selling prices against land prices. Yeah, you've got your build costs, but you can control your build costs to an extent, or you have a relevant amount of certainty. What you don't know 5 years from now or whatever is when what you're going to sell your house for. So you tend to buy land based on, you know, existing prices, and you will work backwards and you will build in a buffer to protect yourself against losing money. And usually most builders will buy land targeting 20% plus margin, taking into account estimate of build costs and so on and so forth. If that price goes up higher than what you factored in, you make a windfall profit. If it goes down, you start writing off land. So the point I want to make is that these kind of margins are usually factored in. What Help to Buy has done is actually changed the absolute amounts of money being made by the house building companies. And that's where I think there has been a windfall. And the problem for companies like Persimmon is that it's selling one of every two of its houses in this scheme. It is heavily, heavily reliant on this scheme.
So you wrote this piece this morning?
Yeah.
At 6 o'clock, I think.
Yes,
you said.
Yeah, very early doors.
I wrote a piece on the same subject yesterday afternoon.
Yeah.
And we've kind of reached the same conclusion.
Yeah.
Which is that these numbers look great. And, you know, for anyone looking at these investments, you might think these are companies that, you know, you want to have. They are extraordinarily profitable. Both you and I have reached the same conclusion, which is when numbers look this good, somebody might start asking questions. That somebody being the government.
And, you know, there was a quite high profile piece in the newspapers at the weekend about build quality, Help to Buy, the government starting to get a little bit concerned about what this scheme is actually doing. Because, you know, what is actually quite clear is that the government has put huge amounts of money behind this scheme, but doesn't seem to have asked for a lot back.
Well, it's asking the house builders to help them meet their promises on home construction in the UK.
Yeah, but do you not think some of these houses would have been built anyway?
Well, yeah.
I think for the house builders to turn round and say, without Help to Buy, we would never have, you know, increased our volumes by so much. I think that's partly true, but I don't think they would have sat back and not built up from 2011, 2012 levels of, you know, volume.
Mm.
But yeah, it has helped to get shovels in the ground. There's no doubt about that.
I was quite surprised when they extended it in the way they did, I have to say. I mean, well, surprised and not surprised at the same time.
Yeah.
Surprised because there are, even at that point, which, when was that, a year or so ago, there were questions being asked as to whether this was absolutely necessary. But then at the same time, not surprised because it's kind of methadone for the housing industry now.
It is, but it's not dealing with the issue. You know, the issue is supply. And yes, I think over the last 18 months, 2 years, if you look at what the private builders have been delivering, yet there's been an uptick in supply, which has been long overdue. But really, this doesn't get to the sort of 300,000 units that the government wants. And the only way, you can't rely on the private builders to deliver it. You need a different solution. And that's what Help to Buy isn't really addressing. It's partly addressing supply at a very high cost. But there is an argument to saying that Help to Buy at the moment hasn't cost the government a penny, because the value of the equity pumped into the houses is not underwater. But that's sort of beside the point. What Help to Buy is doing, it is shifting demand away from the existing house building market into the new build market at a very high price, and also very high levels of debt, particularly for first time buyers. And one of the things I think is incredibly dangerous about this scheme is that it's all very well a new, you know, first time buyer going in and getting a 20% interest free loan for 5 years. What they need to understand is that when they come to sell that house, the buyer of that house won't have the same privileges. And therefore, you get down into a whole debate on valuation. You know, if I'm a mortgage lender and I'm lending money against a new build house on an estate, brand new estate, if the government's taking 20% of the price risk away from me, and the customer's putting 5% of their own money in, I'm quite happy probably to lend 75% of the value. If I've not got that 20% help to buy buffer and I'm on the hook for 95%, I'm going to pay a lot of attention to the price that's being asked for that house. And if I think it's too high, I'll value it down. And this is what happens all the way through in terms of house transactions in a normal functioning market. And we haven't got a normal functioning market here. If you take the 20% buffer away, which is what actually will happen for the next buyer of a help-to-buy property, then the valuation of the lender becomes a lot more crucial. And they might say, if the new build premium is 10-15%, that premium should actually be 5%. And therefore, you've got people who are buying help-to-buy houses today who may be paying over the odds with a lot of debt. Let's face it, 20% interest-free. The capital's still got to get paid back. And the fear would be that this could cause a lot of problems in the future, particularly if the housing market weakens.
Good luck, James Brokenshire, Housing Minister, who I understand you wrote to.
I did write to.
Expressing your concerns.
I did, yeah.
And he appears to have listened. He has himself expressed some concerns this week, maybe, starting to.
Well, I wouldn't say it was down to me.
Ah, Phil, you underestimate yourself. I mean, let's quickly turn to Purple Bricks. The house builders look good. Purple Bricks does not. Is this a casualty of the kind of weakness in the secondary market, or is this just the bad business that's being found out?
I think the problem with Purple Bricks was largely due to its American and Australian business, and its expectations of the level of fees that it could get through have fallen well short. The UK business looks as it was. But I think that the dynamics of the current property market do pose a lot of challenges for Purple Bricks' operating model.
Something you mentioned to me earlier, I mean, you know, Purple Bricks' selling point was that, you know, rather than paying a percentage fee to a traditionalist high street estate agent, you're paying a flat fee. It could work out much cheaper for someone selling their home. But as you mentioned earlier, The high street estate agents have been able to respond to this, which is always a big risk factor in this model.
Yeah, the risk factor is that whilst the initial fee paid, the actual absolute level of fee paid, looks cheap on the face of it, people who list their property through Purple Bricks pay that fee regardless of whether the property is sold or not. And that's not what happens with a traditional no sale, no fee estate agent.
And those traditional estate agents have been able to lower their fees,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, because one of the problems with estate agency, if you're not selling houses, you're not making any money. So if you look at the secondary market, you look at the RICS, the regular RICS data, the Royal Institute of Chartered Surveyors data, you know, they're saying that supply is very, very small. Or and the market isn't moving. Houses are staying on the market for a lot longer than they were.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much you can read into this, but, you know, looking at, you know, second-hand home sales, you know, I look around my area and there doesn't appear to have been that much coming onto the market. No. But I don't know whether I'm imagining it. There seems to have been a spike. There's a lot more balls going up.
Well, you tend to get that in February, March anyway.
Oh, okay.
You know, so a natural sort of spring selling season.
Yeah.
But if you're not selling, you're not making money. But if you're Purple Bricks, you make the money as soon as it gets listed.
Not seeing many Purple Bricks boards, funny enough.
Some people, a lot of people don't have boards, though.
Right.
You know, a lot of people prefer not to sort of publicise on the street that their house is for sale.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah, but you're trying to sell your house.
I know, but I think they just don't want people knocking on their doors.
Shy people, which is very strange in this day and age when everyone puts their entire lives on social media, but there you go.
Yeah, but so this is an issue. I mean, you know, the critics of Purple Bricks have always gone on and said, look, how many houses are you actually selling? That was one thing that started off. I think they have come out and said that now. But you can bet your bottom dollar that traditional bricks and mortar estate agents are going to be pushing the message that if you list with us and your property doesn't sell, you don't pay us anything, or you might pay us a little bit of advertising.
Which is a pretty strong message.
Strong message in a weak market, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's going to be interesting to see how that pans out.
Yeah, indeed. You're not convinced of the long-term prospects of this business.
I have experience. My in-laws ran estate agencies for an estate agent for 30 years, and when they came to sell it, which was admittedly not at a great time, I think 2008, 2009, there were no buyers. And this was for a reasonably sized local estate agent in Cambridgeshire. And, the price-earnings ratio you put to an estate agency business is never going to be a big one.
Yeah. It's like, I used to remember there being lots of sort of local travel agents in the old days. I don't see them anymore, do you?
No.
Same thing, I suppose. Let's talk quickly about your column, Amazon. It's a look at whether, the case for buying Amazon shares. I think we can summarise that reasonably quickly.
Go on, then.
They're expensive.
Yeah.
But this is a great business. And, it could actually deliver on that. The expectations baked into that share price over time.
Well, historically, it has done so.
And because it has done so in the past.
I've had a good look at this. And I'm sure if you're in a local bookshop, you're not a fan of Amazon.
Are there any local bookshops left?
There's a few.
One or
not
two.
Not many. But, even if you are a Cardo, you're probably looking over your shoulder at what Amazon does to you.
Indeed.
There are lots of businesses that have been Amazonized. Amazonized, yeah.
We actually wrote a big feature about this a while back. We called it the Amazon Risk, and it wasn't about booksellers and music sellers. No. It was about all these sort of ancillary industries that Amazon is
fashion.
Logistics.
Yeah.
Logistics being actually a very key sector that Amazon is really making life very difficult for. Grocery retail.
Yeah.
This is a powerful business.
Cloud-based computer.
Cloud-based computer, which is where it makes the bulk of its money.
Yeah, this is a real... They run the cloud-based computing business, Amazon Web Services it's called. Very similar strategy to the retail in that they offer very, very compelling prices to businesses.
Mm, mm.
And they grow through volume. And this is a business that's making close to 30% margin now, whereas Amazon in North America retail is making 2.5%, and it's actually making the same absolute level of profit now as their North American business. And this is a key driver going forward of Amazon's margins. One of the big criticisms of Amazon has always been that it's got loads of sales but not a lot of profit, and it looks now as if that's starting to change, and that the margins now, a lot of it down to Amazon Web Services, but also if you look at the North American retail business, the margins are starting to tick up. There's a lot of investment gone into fulfillment, the supply chain, that is driving a lot of cost efficiencies. And what you've got here is a business that's still got pretty decent sales growth, but you would expect the profits now to start growing a lot faster than sales.
Yeah, that's always been the bit that's missing, conspicuously absent. And it's made the shares look very expensive, but perhaps looking more expensive than in reality they are, given that it invests a lot in its business.
Yeah. And I think it's always been the sort of view that, when does Amazon decide, okay, I've got enough volume here, probably never, but and I'm going to start trying to turn that into more profit.
I mean, I look at this business, it reminds me of sort of science fiction films, 20 years in the future, a company that runs the entire world, the Tyrell Corporation or what it is. I mean, it kind of has that feel about it. It could do anything it wants.
And that's one of the reasons it has a lot of detractors.
Because it could be to get too big.
Yeah. It's like, as consumers, we all like a bargain. We don't want to pay too much for stuff, but then there's always the bit that eventually comes along thinking, okay, yeah, it's great, I can get it cheap, but I don't really want to see the local shop go bust. And that's always a sort of mindset that starts with Amazon. You think, yeah, I like it, I can't deny it's brilliant, but what am I doing if I keep on buying from it?
Having said that, I mean, things like the marketplace, that... It doesn't sell directly everything that is sold through its platform. So, marketplace is supporting small businesses, arguably.
That's not what the EU thinks.
Well, the EU never likes big technology, American like technology Google, businesses.
Never like, no, it, like, it doesn't like...
Is that because it doesn't have any big technology businesses?
Amazon and... Google and Microsoft. But no, I mean, Marketplace is being investigated by the European Commission at the moment.
On what basis?
The basis that it's not a level playing field, that perhaps Amazon uses the data through Marketplace sales to help its own business, and that also in terms of search, the Amazon website perhaps favours Amazon products over Marketplace products.
Well, of course it does.
But I'm not convinced that's true, actually.
Well, no, it does, because it's put, search for a book, its product comes first, but it's quite easy to see the alternative places to buy it.
Exactly, and often it will say, I'm not here to defend Amazon, but it will say, you can get this cheaper through other sellers, click on this link.
Absolutely. Which I do a lot.
So
but not always.
You might have to wait a bit longer for it to be delivered. But this is quite normal. I don't know what will happen, but it's quite normal when you get businesses that start off small and then become very, very big, very, very dominant, that someone will say, oh, we've got to stop this.
Yeah, and they are aggressive. There's no doubt about that. I recently read a book by the FT's undercover economist, a guy called Tim Harford. He wrote a book called Messy.
Yeah.
And actually, the story of Amazon features quite prominently in that book. It's messy. It's aggressive. It kind of breaks things and rebuilds them Yeah. I kind of like it.
You've got to admire it because, it innovates. It innovates and it's very, very customer focused. And, there's lots of lessons for lots of businesses out there in terms of the attention that Amazon in lots of ways is giving the customer what it wants.
Yeah, I guess one of the potential worries is that having broken every other business out there and, cemented its dominance in a particular marketplace, it can then charge what it likes. So yes, it gives the customer what they want, but it can charge what it likes for it.
Potentially, yeah. That is always the nagging worry about any business that can become too dominant.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you see, the thing is that, Amazon is spending loads of money to effectively give it a big competitive advantage. It's investing huge amounts in its warehouses, logistics, it's leasing fleets of planes, it's getting rid of third-party logistics suppliers, it's driving down the cost of delivery. And it has huge amounts of volume and growing amounts of volume to support that investment and make that investment pay off. Now, if you're a competitor to that, how on earth do you compete with that?
Well, you don't, quite
But
frankly.
Is that unfair?
No, because they haven't done this through monopolistic practices.
No.
They've done this through aggressive business practices, but there's nothing monopolistic about that. But
I think you can sum it up saying that they look at places where there's fat margins and lots of business, lots of volume, and say, right, I'll have a go at that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I'm struggling. I struggle in my mind to really get to grips with what I think about Amazon as a company, or indeed as an investment. But
I think there's a little bit of doubt at the moment on terms of how the numbers are going to play out. There's issues in India. Some concern that eventually this business, and it will, have to slow down. And you look at the forecasts that analysts have got out there, and they do look, certainly on the top, even on the top line, I can buy the rationale for margin expansion, still look pretty bullish.
Yeah.
My view and my conclusion at the end of this was that if those are deliverable, then in 3 years' time, at the current share price, Amazon's on a P of 28, which is still high. But if you were holding the shares for 3 years, would you lose money from today? I don't know.
Yeah, we don't know. But it's an interesting one, I think.
Yeah.
I guess even if you're just invested in some of the areas where Amazon is starting to explore, it's definitely worth a read. It's an extraordinary business.
It is.
And another aspect of the business which we haven't talked about is the Prime service, and particularly the music and video streaming service. The video streaming service in particular is interesting in the context of news we've had this week from ITV and the BBC that they are to launch a streaming service of their own. a joint venture called BritBox, which they already sell overseas, don't they?
They've sold overseas in North America, and they've done quite well, I think.
Half a million subscribers.
Yeah, yeah. That's not bad, but if you live in America, you can't really get them, so I can understand why a few people might have bought it.
Yeah, absolutely. Why would anyone in the UK buy this thing? This is what I'm Dom over in the control room shaking his head. I struggle with this. I pay a licence fee to watch the BBC. I don't pay anything to watch ITV because it's funded by ads. Yeah. What am I buying? What are they selling? What am I buying, and why would I buy it?
They've got an extensive back catalogue.
Which you can't get anywhere at the moment.
Yeah, or you can buy DVDs or box sets.
Like my Reggie Perrin box set.
Yeah, your Reggie Perrin. But there's no doubt, this has been the bull case all along, that both these companies have extensive back catalogues and existing production of new programmes that fit quite nicely into a streaming service.
Okay, so let me get my head around this. This is not a replacement for the iPlayer, which is essentially...
I don't know.
So we don't know enough about this. So.
It could... You know, this is one of the key unknowns. You know, what does the BBC do with the iPlayer? The BBC has tried to put more content onto the iPlayer. Ofcom has turned around and say, no, you can't do that. That's unfair to commercial broadcasters like ITV and Channel 4. And
I have to say, so on that subject, you know, there are things that the BBC produces and puts on the iPlayer and that I want to watch that I forget about, and by the time I go back there, it's gone. And, you know, it might be unfair to ITV, but I pay my licence fee and I would like to watch that.
Yeah.
And I find the idea that I'm going to have to pay another £5 a month or whatever it is so that I can watch those things that have been taken off the iPlayer that I've already paid for, I'm struggling to get my head around
And
this.
There are lots of people who have the same view.
Lots of people cancelling their licence fee at the moment.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the licence fee, it looks like this is another issue that's going to rise up the political agenda, despite the extension of the charter, to 2026 or whatever. I think for ITV, you can understand why they want to do this.
The ITV hub is quite poor, actually.
It is poor. It also, you know, it's got lots of ads on it. And consumers don't want ads. You know, if you're paying a monthly subscription, it's one of the big gripes that people have with Sky, actually. So they hand over loads of money and they still get loads of ads.
Yeah, so I think Sky has something like 10 million subscribers still at the moment, which actually I think it's about to be overtaken by Netflix.
Yeah.
I think Netflix is approaching 10 million or will have hit that by the end of Q1.
Yeah, it's getting close. And BBC, there's a lot of ITV and BBC content on Netflix.
A lot of Disney content on there as well, which is being taken off too.
I'd be quite bearish on Netflix, actually, going off at a tangent, because traditional broadcasters can see Netflix destroying their businesses or damaging their business with their own content. And they're going to say, hold on a minute, we're not going to give you a stick to beat us with. We're going to take that stick away and we're going to take our content and we're going to put it on our own streaming thing.
Mm.
But you see, there's so many streaming services now. You know, how many is the consumer really, really going to buy? And, you know, what is the actual monetary value of, certainly for ITV, let's park the license fee debate for somewhere else.
Yeah, but there are plenty of angry people on the on the internet who talk about that.
But for ITV is, you know, getting about 1.7, 1.8 billion pounds a year from TV advertising. It's a very, very, the broadcasting business has essentially a fixed cost base. And therefore, the movement year to year of ad revenue has a big impact on the direction of its profits. And in a recession, it gets hammered. And so this has always been what's put so many long-term investors off investing in ITV.
Yeah,
because it's too reliant on this.
And it does. I mean, when you look at its numbers, when you look at its share price, it does look like it should be a share to buy. But it's really struggling to gain any momentum.
It's a very profitable business.
Absolutely. And it's got a very good chief executive in Carolyn McCall, actually, who did wonders at EasyJet.
Yeah. But
all the right ingredients, but it's not happening with the share price.
Yeah, and you think, what does a streaming service that, you know, the pricing hasn't been mentioned yet, but I've seen the figure of £5 mentioned quite a lot.
Yeah.
You know, let's say you get 10 million subscribers, which is a big, big task, I think, given the competition from Amazon, Netflix, Now TV. So you would be getting 600 million of revenue a year. Half your share of that's 300. Now, that's all right. But does it offset the structural and secular long-term decline in TV ad spend? I'm not sure it does.
I guess the conclusion could be that we are at an inflection point with the media industry as we know it. And things could change in a way that we can't predict right now.
Yeah, I mean, the BBC is under massive pressure.
So in that sense, this is an industry which, because of all these moving parts, because of all this competition, this proliferation of services, it's kind of becoming a little bit uninvestable in some respects. Just because there are too many unknowns.
Yeah, I mean, even for Netflix, you know, I would worry if I'm Netflix, I'm running Netflix UK, I'm probably quite worried by this, because I'm potentially going to lose. When the contract expires, I'm going to lose a lot of content.
And it takes us back to Amazon, which has so much strength in depth, as it were. Even as this picture plays out and as it becomes clear, Amazon has a streaming service, which is not going to go away, and it can wait and see. It's making its money elsewhere.
But it's not just the streaming service. You know, you pay your £79 a year for Prime, and you get much more than a video service.
Absolutely, absolutely. Take us back to Amazon. I think I'm buying the Amazon shares. Short Netflix by Amazon.
I think this is quite a controversial subject. We had, you know, had something that was known as Project Kangaroo probably a decade or so ago, which was about putting together the catalogues of the main terrestrial broadcasters, and it got blocked. We've had the Ofcom sort of speaking quite harshly to the BBC about shoving stuff on the iPlayer. So there is a huge regulatory risk to this proposition. And you've got to have some sympathy with the likes of ITV, because BBC doesn't have to fish for its summer. It just gets everyone's tax to watch live TV, and all the money goes to the BBC.
Mm. On pain of imprisonment if you don't pop up.
But ITV definitely does have to fish for its supper, and it's not been allowed really to try and monetize a lot of its content. Or actually, no, I'll take that back. It hasn't done it. You know, it hasn't made a good job of the ITV player.
Having said that, its studios businesses are being heavily invested in, and they are making content which they are shipping around the world.
But there was nothing really to stop ITV setting up its own subscription business anyway with its back catalogue. Why hasn't it done it? Maybe because it thinks it isn't broad, it doesn't have the broad enough appeal, and therefore with the BBC putting those two together, it's quite an attractive proposition. The problem is, all this dithering in the meantime has allowed Netflix and Amazon to come in and grab that monthly subscription revenue from households.
Yeah.
And people will rightly ask, saying, look, I'm paying, I don't know what it works out, £6.50 a month if you buy an annual Amazon Prime, let's say £8 for Netflix if you want the HD version, £8 for, or whatever it is, or £10 for Now TV. Do I want to spend another £5 on BritBox, especially when I'm paying £12.50 a month BBC licence fee as well? It starts adding up and becoming a significant monthly outlay.
Absolutely, especially as I own the Reggie Perrin box set anyway, on DVD. Oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Actually, I do own quite a lot of BBC DVDs, box sets. This is because that was the model, and lots of people have bought those things.
But yeah, you know,
I guess they're hoping everyone throws away their DVD players. So.
Which I think people are.
I know they are.
But it's,
and I'm buying all their DVDs from the cherry shop. Yeah.
But what does this solve for ITV? As an investor, that is the question that you've got to ask. What is this solving for ITV? Does it plug a hole that's going to get bigger in terms of ad revenue? I think that's fair to assume that.
But I guess the alternative for ITV is that it does nothing and sees sees itself becoming irrelevant.
Yeah, it has to do this. It's arguably taken too long to do this. But is this the right solution? The BBC is a problem because the licence fee is going to get brought into this.
Yeah, well, the debate's raging hard already.
Yeah, so. I mean, you know, I've got a lot of sympathy with that argument. People are all, the licence fee, I can see both sides of the argument. People think it's great value. Other people think it's a grossly unfair payment in certainly what given the choices that we have today.
Am I right in thinking there are plans to make the licence fee free for pensioners?
No, what they want to do is shift the cost of free TV licences from the taxpayer to the BBC.
Right.
And that cost is about £700 million a year.
Yes.
For over seven. So the BBC is very, very unhappy about what is going to blow a massive hole in its coffers.
Yeah, God, it sounds like a mess.
It is a mess. I'm not convinced it sorts out ITV. I'm not convinced it can certainly quickly enough address the concerns of investors that it's still too reliant on ad income.
Fascinating. Especially as we may be going into some very difficult economic times.
Who knows?
Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? Anyway, thank you very much, Phil. That's a very wide-ranging debate there. Just to talk you through what else we've got in this week's issue, it's actually our ISA special week, as we're coming up to that time of year, 50 super ISA ideas. It's a supplement with 50 ISA ideas in it, from shares to funds to ETFs and investment trusts, and some practical advice on how to actually buy these things and include them within your portfolios. Feature-wise, apart from that, Philip Ryland's had a look at debt and how companies should be assessed on the debt that they hold, in particular, the rate at which they grow their debt. Lots in the results section this week. We're getting to that time of year where companies start releasing their numbers. And lots going on. One notable result this week is Metro Bank, which has had a pretty bit of a shocker lately. But yeah, lots more apart from that. And lots of the news section, including some of the things we've discussed in this podcast. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you again, Phil. Get to your nearest newsagent, pick up the magazine, 50 Super ISA Ideas, how to get the most from your 2019 tax-free allowance, or pop onto the website and subscribe. Speak soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.